everyone. I will greet everyone and make some announcements. Good morning to Mick, John, Coral, John, Dave, Sandy, Ruthann, Joe, Ken, Doriel, Jeffrey, Bob K, Shoketsu, Linda R, Paulette, Yeshe Tsioki, Diane, Marv, Tyler, oh no, when I went to the next screen, it did something irrational. Sabrina and Vin. If I missed anyone, I'm sorry, I did try. I didn't expect it to shuffle them that way. So, some quick announcements before we get into the talk. We'll have one more Sangha member talk after this for July. Tyler will be leading a class this Tuesday on a koan from the Book of Householder Koans. And that means Domyo should be back next Sunday, August 1st. This Wednesday, the 29th, at 7:30 Pacific Standard Time, Mick will be hosting the Sandokai discussion group. I think it's the last session on the 29th, and you can find the details on the website calendar. Starting in August on Wednesdays at 5, a peer-led study group will begin focusing on Domyo's podcast, and details for that are also on the website calendar. And we hope to have a Sangha picnic on Saturday, August 14th. Keep an eye out for details there, since the COVID situation may dictate a few considerations about food or distance or masking or whatever. It's still a very dynamic situation. And there will be a multi-day retreat hosted at Brightway at the end of August, starting on the 23rd, which is also, I believe, the day we intend to reopen now. And then, if no one else has any announcements to make, I'll begin the talk. All right. So, it's challenging to give a freestanding talk without an assigned topic and to try and pull things together. And this one's personal in that it's a recounting of a journey or investigation I've been going through for the last few months, ever since I started term student. And as I worked on the talk, several old koans and quotes and poems came to mind as being relevant. And the funny thing is, for a discussion of authentic effort, is it really appropriate to be bringing up the words of ancient monks when they could so easily be used or misconstrued as an appeal to authority? At the same time, is it really appropriate to leave them out and still presume that me rambling at you for a half an hour is a talk about Zen? So I left them in the end, but that kind of leaves it on you as my audience to bring the appropriate doubt to the table. Today's talk is titled My Koan of Authentic Effort. And it comes from me informally, obviously, engaging a koan I found interesting. And it's a koan between Yaoshan, who's Yakusan Igen from our lineage recitation, and a novice named Gao. And it begins with Yaoshan asking Gao where he comes from, and Gao says he comes from the capital. Yaoshan says, I hear the capital city is really busy. And the novice says, my province is peaceful. He's not talking about his hometown anymore. Yaoshan says, did you realize this from reading scripture or from making inquiries? And the novice says, I didn't get it from reading scriptures or from making inquiries. Yaoshan says, lots of people don't read scriptures or make inquiries. Why don't they get it? The novice says, I wouldn't say they don't get it. It's just that they don't agree to take it up. and a different translation of this koan, which is actually the one I ended up getting when I bought the book, the line is given as won't take responsibility for it, which is in a way even better translation, but I've had the they don't agree to take it up in my head for much longer. I'm very fond of it. And because my style is very much reading scriptures and making inquiries, this was right in my strike zone. And there was something really juicy in asking myself, what is agreeing to take it up? So I did what I do. I made an inquiry. And that's where this talk comes from. And that inquiry is, what is the role of effort in a life of practice? To what or in what direction do we apply ourselves? And personally, I have a pretty twisted relationship with effort, with working, and with aspiration in general. I'm probably not the only one. Agreeing to take it up sounds kind of odd to me. Work is what I do to keep the wolf from my door. So you can either do it or you can later wish you had. What could agreeing or disagreeing have to do with it? You can hear in this a sense of slightly bitter resignation at a requirement imposed from the outside. So this investigation comes from an intuition that there's a more authentic way to apply effort. I'll tell you a parable now about work, causation, cultivation. It's about the building of a cathedral. In the Middle Ages, it took generations to build a cathedral, and the one in this story used massive, massive wooden beams to hold up the roof. But nothing lasts forever, and when the ceiling beams began to weaken from insect damage, the people responsible for doing the repairs began to search for suitable replacement timbers. They discovered then that a perfect grove of old growth trees was right there on cathedral grounds. In fact, they'd been planted there centuries before by the very people who built the cathedral originally, knowing that one day those ceiling beams would need to be replaced. Now, when I first heard this story, saw a slightly different version of this story. It was being used to make a point about sustainability, but it stayed with me because it's such a good metaphor for how human life always is. Metaphorically, we build our lives using timbers from trees we did not plant that don't really belong to us. We inherit our circumstances from the past as left behind by someone who's not really us, but is not really separate from us either. Even just by living normally, we plant trees that we'll never harvest into timber, and those don't really belong to us either. We bequeath what we build and cultivate to the future, to be inherited by someone who's not really us, but not really separate from us either. That whole process is, you know, referred to here as building a cathedral, but if you look closely, no part of it belongs to us at all. And yet, nobody else can receive this particular inheritance in this particular place and time. And there's nobody else who can build or cultivate in our particular place. As Kotosawaki once said, you can't exchange so much as a fart with the next guy. So we end up being responsible for what doesn't belong to us. And that's one of life's weird little sticking points because it feels like a contradiction. If it's not ours, how could we possibly be responsible for it? If we're responsible for it, doesn't that mean it's actually ours? What's more, this process is continuous, right? We're always in the midst of circumstances, always receiving that inheritance, and we're always participating fully in the world. We're always hands-on, even when we call it doing nothing. And so we're always leaving some inheritance behind. The relentlessness of this can be pretty intimidating, but looking at it from another angle, the vital creative moment is always right here. We live our whole lives as the turning point between past and future. So there's this sense of an urgent task and a precious opportunity and an unavoidable responsibility all rolled into one. And that's the life of causation. And part of my usual response to that is to get anxious about what I should do. What's the right thing to do? So, since we can't avoid cultivating an inheritance any more than we can avoid receiving one, what do we cultivate and how? Is what we cultivate even the point? Excuse me for a moment. Here, the cathedral story from earlier has come to the end of its usefulness, by the way. Not everybody inherits an old-growth forest for timber or a pile of fancy Italian marble to build with. Some days we inherit popsicle sticks and maybe a birdhouse is the best you can do. Some days the cathedral bequeathed is received as a birdhouse, and some days the birdhouse bequeathed is received as a cathedral. So I'm not talking about some conventional notion of good, better, and best here. Despite that, something, some aspiration remains in the face of all that uncertainty. Even if we can say there's nothing wrong anywhere in this world, that all phenomena are marked by perfect dignity and universal support, etc., etc., I didn't come to a Zen center 8 years ago because things were fine, just as they were, and I haven't remained because I thought there was nothing to be done, and thus no place for effort. But when I aspire in a certain way to be a good Buddhist or a bodhisattva or something even more audacious like an enlightened Buddha, I find suffering is never long in coming. The last time this happened, I found that when I formed an ideal in this way, I was actually attaching to that ideal. I was attaching a little imaginary self over there and saying, that's where you're supposed to be, and you're not living up to it. And looking from the place I'd assigned myself to be to the place I actually was, I couldn't help but suffer in the gap. Of course, that's actually just one way of misusing ideals, the one I'm most familiar with. I wonder if another different relationship with an attached ideal might be to say, enlightenment? Oh, no, not me, not this lifetime, no. I'm placing that ideal far out of reach and keeping it there. Maybe that's just another way of imagining a fixed self. Seems to me it doesn't matter all that much which side of that gap you put yourself on. So, investigating. What's going on? Digging. It's one of my favorite things to do. They say each of the four Brahma Viharas has a far enemy and a near enemy. The far enemy is its obvious opposite, and the near enemy is like a dangerous look-alike, in the same way that a wily fox looks like a loyal dog. Aspiration isn't a Brahma Vihara, but it seems to me that what I've been calling aspiration is actually aspiration's near enemy. In the Platform Sutra, Huinang offers a useful admonition. He says, learned audience, it has been the tradition of our school to take idealistness as our object, non-objectivity as our basis, and non-attachment as our fundamental principle. Idealistness means not to be carried away by any particular idea in the exercise of the mental faculty. Non-objectivity means not to be absorbed by objects when in contact with objects. Non-attachment is the characteristic of our essence of mind. And what is an attached to ideal, if not a failure to uphold the idealistness that he describes? So if that's true, then we have to be able to say what genuine aspiration is. And maybe the answer is in the word itself. The spear in aspiration and spirit is the same one that's in respiration. It just means breath, which was once synonymous with life force. Aspiration literally means to breathe upon, or what the life force goes towards. But of course, in order to go towards an aspiration, it has to come from us. The origin is here where we are, not over where some attached to ideal is. It's a direction rather than a destination, although I will buy that back later. We can't suffer in the gap if there isn't one, so I find this is a much more skillful use of that energy. I think of this as living from values instead of up to ideals, and it's been a huge positive change in my life. To such an extent that I was originally just going to end the talk there with just that finding, but it turns out there's much further to go. I asked before, what do we cultivate? So then is the answer we cultivate according to our values? Is cultivating according to our values the answer to my koan of authentic effort? Well, Yes and no. I can see two traps surrounding values. First one's easy, and it's particularly relevant for me. If I ask, okay, what are my values, things immediately take a turn for the worse again. They're easy enough to come up with. Non-coercion comes to mind. I can point straight at the parts of my life that made me that way. But if I say non-coercion is one of my values, I've turned it into an attached to ideal again, and I'm right back where I started from. Second, my example value of non-coercion was derived from looking back at my life. It's a description of how I've lived and how I tend to live. One of any number of valid descriptions, actually. The underlying life lived, the genuine article, is nothing but the flow of causes and conditions, receiving an inheritance, leaving an inheritance. Then saying we cultivate according to our values is really saying we cultivate according to our causes and conditions, which is kind of a non-statement, right? Of course we do. That's an all-inclusive term. What else is there to cultivate according to? So the more I look at it, the more it seems to me that my values don't need any special care and feeding. They emerge naturally like anything else. And if concretizing them into a possession called my values ruins them, then are they really even any of my business at all? After all, if they emerge naturally, there's no need to know what they are. I just need to know how it is right now. What's more, people have all kinds of lives and all kinds of values emerge from them. The desire for wealth, fame, and power are all technically values in the way that I'm using the term. Will any old value really satisfy the koan of authentic effort? No, I don't think so. When I talk about the koan of authentic effort, I'm talking about a kind of effort that doesn't obliterate authenticity by straining towards some fabricated ideal, nor does it obliterate itself by collapsing into a kind of naive naturalism. So, and this is one of the parts of the talk where I'm unsatisfied with the talk because I don't think I've done it very cleanly, but I think I've separated value-driven cultivation of particular results from authentic effort-driven aspiration. I'd go so far as to say this aspiration I'm talking about doesn't have a direction, or rather that its direction is towards life as a whole, which doesn't lie off in some particular direction. And that brings us to a classic koan. This is case 19 in the Wu Men Guan. Zhao Zhou asked Nanchuan, "What is the way?" Nanchuan said, "The normal mind is the way." Zhao Zhou asked, "Can it be approached deliberately?" Nanchuan said, "If you try to aim for it, you thereby turn away from it." Zhao Zhou asked, "If one does not try, how can one know it is the way?" Nanchuan said, "The way is not in the province of knowing, yet not in the province of unknowing. Knowledge is false consciousness. Unknowing is indifference. If you really arrive at the way, it is like space, empty and open. How can you insist on affirmation and denial?" The version of the Wu Men Guan I'm reading from here has some great commentaries and verses by other masters other than Wu Men who pulled this book together to begin with. Some ostensibly bald fellow named Fujian said, "If you want to know the normal way, trust nature spontaneously. When you row a boat, you need to raise the oars. When you ride a horse, you apply the crop. If you get hungry, obtain some food, and you should sleep when tired. All is attained through conditions, yet what is attained is not a condition." And that last line is dynamite, right? Pointing at conditions as a means for attaining something that transcends conditions. So what is the aspiration, the going towards, that transcends conditions and has no particular direction? Isn't it just attention? Or some version of attention. A monk out at Great Vow once told me that attention is love, and I do find that to be true. And it's not a directed focused attention I'm talking about here, where you put your focus on something and it stays there where you put it. For one thing, I find that kind of attention hard to come by, especially when I'm tired or stressed out. For another, just by having an object, that kind of attention has a direction, an ideal, which puts it squarely in that realm of cultivation we just left. Nanchuan warns against affirmation and denial, and Seng San says the way only avoids picking and choosing. Just lost my place in my notes. So there's a sense in which lifting one object of attention up and discriminating it as being good is indistinguishable from pushing all the others down and discriminating them as bad. How could that be love in the sense that it's being used here? Huinong says non-objectivity is our basis and goes on to say that means not to be absorbed by objects when in contact with objects. Another translation says no form, and that it means being free from form in the presence of forms. It points at a kind of a root level, all-hosting attention here that can hold even the thoughts that cognize forms as being mere activity within awareness, not being fooled by objects in the midst of objects. This is the moment that James and Norman Fisher last week described as the onion not yet divided by the knife, and even the knife not divided from the onion. To me, it's just pay attention and don't be fooled by anything. And when I arrived at that, I knew I was on the home stretch because it's almost exactly a line from yet another old koan that I'll get to in a minute. First, a digression that I hope is at least interesting. I haven't been able to convince myself it's truly relevant to the talk, but it's too neat to leave out. Elsewhere in the Platform Sutra, Huinong says that this samadhi, the root attention, and prajna, the not being fooled by things, are inseparable, like a lamp and its light. And in the Zazen Yojinki, Keizan says that our Zazen is nothing but the samadhi in which all Buddhas receive and use themselves as Buddhas. Receiving an inheritance, crafting an inheritance by means of an inheritance with loving attention. So if it's like that, does it really matter if it's oak beams or popsicle sticks, a birdhouse or a cathedral? And that talk of inheritance brings us full circle, which is no coincidence. Within the Noble Eightfold Path, we sometimes talk about the threefold division, sila, ethical conduct, samadhi, single-pointed concentration, and prajna, transcendental wisdom, which have three, three, and two of the elements of the Noble Eightfold Path within them, respectively. Right effort, correct effort, falls into the samadhi division. So people who are more inclined to and familiar with that old teaching may well have spotted where this was going before I did. Because the three practices of sila, samadhi, and prajna form a simplified version of the eight-spoke dharma wheel, a kind of dharma triangle, it makes a kind of sense that when I asked what is agreeing to take it up, I started with activity, causation, which is just emptiness itself in its apparent aspect, prajna, which led me to ask questions about skillful cultivation, sila, which led me to ask about the condition transcending quality that underlies that, samadhi, which leads to not being fooled by things, seeing lively emptiness, back to prajna. I pulled on this one little thread thinking, hey, what's this hooked up to? And the answer turns out to be the entire dharma wheel, which incidentally is why I've been so frustrated with this talk as I worked on it, so much to fit in. But having come all the way back round on this trip, how could I dare to leave any of it out? How could I dare to imply that the ending point was something other than the starting point? So, for better or for worse, I promised you one last koan, and I'm sorry, but I'm munging together several translations here because this koan's become very important to me, and the wording matters. It's case 12 from the Wu Mengguan again. Every day, Zuigan would call out, "Master!" And he would answer, "Yes." "Be awake. Be alert." "Yes." "And from now on, don't be fooled by anyone." "Yes, yes." Even though this is a wonderful response to the koan of authentic effort, still Wu Men cautions us in his commentary. Old Zuigan sells himself and buys himself, playing with so many masks. Why? Listen, one who calls, one who answers, one who is alert, one who is not fooled by others. If you cling to recognition, as before, you are not right. But if you were to imitate Zuigan, this would be the understanding of a wild fox. So I don't think I get to wrap up the talk without responding to my own first koan, the story of agreeing to take it up. What about the peaceful province of Gao? And I think I'll respond by turning Zuigan's story inside out. Every day the master of the province would call out, "Mark, what? Go home, you're drunk. Don't tell me what to do, old man. Come on, you look like 10 miles of bad road. Why don't you get some rest?" "Well, I'm pretty tired. I mean, ideas are a lot heavier than they look." And that's where my response stands today. And that's the entirety of the talk. So I will open it up for questions and general discussion. Away we go.
Thank you, Mark. That was a really wonderful talk. I wrote down a couple of things that you had said, and I thought it was really interesting because I find that this idea of what you kind of call like natural effort or just sort of like this difference is it is kind of frustrating in a way that you feel like whenever I do something, it's always overcooked or undercooked. You know, and like trying to find that sweet spot seems so difficult. And you read, you know, or however you might want to find where that sweet spot is. And it always seems just sort of like it's always this like vague description of like you'll know it when you see it or something. And it's just so hard because it like effort is an expression of a naturally emerging feeling. And I always think of like great jazz music and people are like, "Oh, Miles Davis, he just like lets go of all the rules and he just plays," you know? And you're like, "Well, you know, I don't think I could do that without knowing like scales. And so like what do I need to like put together before I can like let it all go?" And I feel like there's a bunch of steps that kind of get forgotten when experts are like, you know, just like just let the brush carry you or something, and you're like, "I don't know how to hold it." I don't know. I feel like that's the big gap that I always see is like, I'm over here trying out the basics and, you know, Hongzhi is telling me to just let it all go. And I don't know what to let go of. I don't know what I'm holding on to that I should let go of.
Yeah. Yeah. The thought of the way that even thinking that there's a balance to be found implies that balance is a matter of applying your effort correctly, right? Like the answer to effort is more effort, the right effort, just the right amount of effort. And then these Zen masters are like, "No, can all of that." And it seems impossible without that trust that Fojian talks about, right? Without a sense that there's something that can be fallen back to and trusted, it's always going to be that trying to balance the Jenga tower and keep it just right It's always going to produce anxiety without that underlying trust. Well, it's a student talk, so it's legitimate to say, does anybody want to pick a fight with this talk? Right? Did I get anything wrong?
Hey, Mark, I'm not picking a fight and you didn't get it wrong. You know, everybody approaches Buddhism in different directions. So there's no really right or wrong. It's how we get it, depending on our makeup. And I'm reasonably new to Zen because I've tried other kinds of Buddhism. And the best part I like about Zen is Shikantaza, where you're sitting and doing nothing. There's no mind activity. And a byproduct of constantly sitting is that we gain the insights and wisdom without effort. It's just from the practice of sitting that it happens to us. The thing I don't like about koan so much, and this is me, because I used to be so intellectual. I mean, you know, you go through college and your brain is spinning all the time. And now I've come to where just a simple talk like what you did on koans gives me a headache, because that's me. Because it seems like there's a lot of mind activity to figure out what the koan is trying to confuse you about, and that before you get to the realization. So it's kind of an in-between step that doesn't work for me. And in fact, where I'm at right now is I've been paying attention to the Heart Sutra very much. And I after all these years, what's glaring at me is the part in the Heart Sutra that says there is no attainment and nothing to attain. And it's because of that, that because of no attainment, that the bodhisattvas have no obstruction in their minds. And thus they overcome the fear and they realize perfect nirvana. So it's just that they have no obstruction. They're not doing all this thinking, is this this way? And is so I'm just saying that I'm trying to grasp what that means about no attainment and nothing to attain and just chill. I mean, sit on the cushion and let it happen without trying to puzzle over it. Well, just that's where I'm coming from. But I haven't studied as much as you, but it's just the way I feel right now. But thank you very much for your talk.
So I find koans inspiring, and I also find it very comforting that even 1,000 years ago people were hashing over the stuff that I am. But there's another great line in the Song of Faith and Mind where Sengsan says, excessive talking and thinking turn you from harmony with the way. And I can't quite bring myself to come to a point, and I don't actually think I'm supposed to, where I say thinking is problematic, don't do it. I don't want to be a stone. But there's this experienced reality where it's like Mara is constantly fishing for my brain. Right? The Lord of Delusion is constantly fishing for bodhisattvas. And I don't know what he's using for bait, but it's delicious. And it's bad luck for Mara and great luck for me that the universe is catch and release. that I get to try again. And that's largely how Zazen works for me. Some particularly tasty piece of mental bait will get taken and I'll get yanked. And then I end up back in the water. I return again and again and again. Whatever comes of that, I think it'll be worthwhile.
Joan, I thought it was really interesting that you brought up Shikantaza, because we actually on Thursday in our Sandokan group, we ran into this sort of like talking about like where Shikantaza fits into all this, where Zazen fits. And that's what I found like really curious is like, okay, well, there's this effort, but like Okay, effort. Does that mean that I like read several books and figure it out? Or do I just like sit a bunch and is like volume in Zazen equal to effort? Or like what? And Shohaku Okamura, who wrote Living by Vow, has this wonderful quote that like turned on some light bulbs for me about specifically about Zazen. He's talking about darkness and light in terms of relative and absolute, because it's Sankai, but he says, we actualize both darkness and light when we open our hand of thought and are not moved. That is sitting practice. Our Zazen is not a method to contemplate reality, which has lightness and dark. It is a way to manifest both darkness and light. We are not the observer, but rather the reality itself. I don't know what to do with that, but it flipped a switch somewhere.
So, Mark, thanks for your talk. You always have little tidbits that are really juicy and interesting. Joan, I can appreciate what you're saying because I've struggled with particularly, well, all kinds of Buddhism, but Zen being hyper-intellectual, and there gets to a point where I like the koans in a way because whether I like them or not doesn't matter. But because it kind of takes you somewhere and then it kind of frustrates your brain and helps you realize that there's more to this than mental thoughts and intellectualizing. Like, it's almost like when you run on a treadmill, you get so exhausted and you realize like there's something beyond the physical. You know, it's something beyond the mental. But yeah, I can completely understand where you're coming from because that's been kind of a frustration for me too. Sometimes I just don't want to deal with the intellectual stuff. My whole job is about that. So, but Mark, I really liked that last quote that you ended with, and I would love to know what it was again because I completely related to it. It was something about... I forget. It was about the mind overthinking, something to do with that.
The mind overthinking.
Maybe I'm wrong, but.
Was it in the Zwigan koan?
You ended with it, I believe.
Ideas are heavier than they look.
Yeah.
Yeah. I kind of have to hope that the pursuit of intellectual pursuit of Zen exhausts itself, right? Like at some point, the road of intellect has to lead to the end of the road of intellect, right? And I've experienced that, right? You know, you meditate and you settle out and suddenly, you know, there's nothing to think about. And, you know, you can do that in everyday life as well. Just get on with it in a nice, straightforward way. But, you know, I do like to pick things apart and see how they fit together. So there's this thought I have in my head that the road of intellect leads to the end of the road of intellect, and what intellect can't touch lies just off the end of the road. Or, you know, maybe if you're the kind of person who can accomplish this, maybe you just take a hard right and go off road right now. both of them are places the road of intellect does not reach.
So was there an answer to the koan?
There aren't answers to the koan.
That's a loaded one, isn't it?
Yeah. No, the talk originally ended with me saying that agreeing to take it up is only found in taking it up.
It's interesting. My wife one time, she said, you can't believe everything you think. And I was like, what are you, a Buddhist? Was like, where did that come from? And it was just so right on. It was just like, hey, what have I been working at here? It's kind of like what you said with the natural thing. It's you're there, and before you know, you're there. So.
Yeah, it's a similar saying meaning the same thing is think about what you're thinking about.
Ruthann?
Oh, Mark, your talk was fun, actually, till I think your last statement, like, what did I do wrong? And I thought, oh, no, because I was, it's like action, no action. Payment Children says, be willing to walk away from what you think are your value systems. So I appreciated the talk, but you're asking, what did I do wrong? I thought, oh, wait a minute. You went off screen. That jarred me. I was ready to say yes, yes. So at any rate, thank you. I appreciate it. It's refreshing, I find Cohen's like beautiful balloons. We can watch them and let go of them and take them in as sort of we're ready or they're ready for us. Thanks again.
I didn't mean it in the sense of what did I do wrong. I just think, like I said in the beginning, and I'll expand on it, I really think authority has no place in Zen, right? Because what makes Zen teachings worth hearing is that they're descriptions of the reality we all live in, which means they're all verifiable. If they're verifiable, there's no need for authority. If they're not verifiable, you can't afford to extend authority to them. So for me, the fact that you're completely free to just pick a fight with a teaching that doesn't make sense to you is one of the wonderful things about Zen. So I was inviting people to pick a fight if that was where they were.
Thank you.
Mark, this is Jin Ryu, and I'm gonna travel incognito today. I love the talk. I knew that it would be very intellectually stimulating. I'm in the camp of a couple of folks who've spoken about over-intellectualizing Zen. For me, Zazen is the most important thing. And then taking that practice into my everyday life. In terms of the over-intellectualization, I think of people in great distress, people in poverty, single mothers with two or three kids, working more than two jobs to keep everything together. And I doubt that those people intellectualize that much. And yet, I would like to see them have a practice too. I don't know what their practice should look like. They have to decide that. But I always think about them, and I always think about them as being the people I vow to set free, among others. And the other thing I wanted to say about the quote that Mick brought up about from Shohaku Okamura, to me, that quote said, you're not in the center of the circle. You're just a part of the circle. And I have to remember that. I think that's about all I have, but it was a great talk, Martin. Thank you.
Thank you. Yeah. It's worth saying, we had that Wei Nong quote about idealistness. And while I was putting the talk together, I was reading Musō Sōseki, who's a Rinzai Zen master from the generation after Dogen. And he has all these things to say about, you know, people who haven't realized the way will only blind people with dogma. And tying that dogma to that, to idealistness, I sincerely hope I haven't given anybody any ideas today, right? This is one of the reasons why I brought it all in a circle and tied it up so that there was no beginning and no end. Because the point wasn't to give people things to cling to. And if I did, spit it out. And also, I'm sorry. That was one of my great fears putting this together, was that I would blind people with dogma.
Well, I mean, I actually kind of enjoyed that about your talk. And I think that's what draws me to koans is it's the idea that there's a richness to them and there's a lot to be kind of like figured out, but there's also nothing to figure out, you know, like, and I think your talk, I mean, I think you built it very carefully to have that balance where you were kind of like, you know, maybe it all means something, but then just like, nope, we're right back at the start. And I think the idea is like, I mean, it's so difficult because in the next moment, you have to decide to do something. You've got to do something. And so, you know, part of our sort of like lives in practice is like choosing a thing to do. If life is a choose your own adventure book, you have to go to the next page. You have to. And the idea is that like, what decision-making matrix, how do I pick which one to go to? How do I pick which one to turn to? And ultimately, you know, that's something that only you can do. And I think that if you're looking to Zen or authority to tell you what page to go to, then you know, I don't know. That's probably not it.
Yeah. Or using your own ideas as an authority. This is the page I should go to. Yeah.
So Mark, in response to your fear about, I can't remember how you said it, overloading us with dogma or...
Blinding
us with dogma. My response would be, what makes you think you're that powerful? And I don't come at that from a high place. Someone said that to me once. And it is pretty amusing when I think about it that way.
Yeah.
I think that's letting go of the result.
I don't think anybody could be blinded by dogma for very long. Since... I know it doesn't work.
Could I just say that it's great to have Jinru on board? Yeah, you made my day. It's always good to have you on board on Sundays.
Thanks, Joan.
I think Brian's got a hand up. Brian, and then Ken's got his hand up right after that. So, Brian, what you got?
What a relief that you ended at the beginning, because I came late. And now I don't feel like I missed anything. So, that's good. And I wanted to note that, at least since I'm not familiar really with traditional koan practice, I've been fortunate in having the occasional koan pop up just in the course of daily life. And one of them was many years ago, someone in a completely different context said, take the to me off of it. It's happening. You're here, but it's not happening just to you. Mm-hmm. And that resonated or came to mind when sort of talking about the self and kind of where we fit in and all of that and stuff. And sometimes I do think that if we do get that moment of insight into sort of what is happening without putting ourselves right in the middle, as was said earlier, you know, that in a way does give us a bit of an insight. That was it.
Thanks.
Then Ken, you've got your hand up.
Yeah, just real quick. This just reminds me everything that is going on. Just real quick. When I was a couple of months ago, I was Sanjo Kai, Cuckoo, Banana Pants. I was like all about it. I'm really sorry that I can't be on at the Thursday meetings because I'm seriously disappointed that I can't catch them. I hope there's recordings of them. But I told I have a Rinzai Roshi I talk to regularly. And when I was going through my love affair with the Sandokai, I told him about it. And he was like, oh, I've never heard of it. Maybe I'll take a look. So that to me is something about action, direction, where we put our energy, dogma. It's all I don't know. I'm not going to say anything about what it means because I don't know what it means, but I'm just that you can reach enlightenment and have never heard of any of these texts, which is comforting because I'm a slow reader.
Skype. Yeah, Novice Gal seems to have done just fine without any of it, right?
I think Joseph's got a hand up, and then we'll go to Diane. Brian, I'm going to assume your hand is expired.
Thanks, Mick. I appreciate it. And Ken, Cuckoo Banana Pants. So that's you made my day with that. So I appreciate it. And I love how you just own it and get out there because I think we all feel that way a little bit sometimes. I've just been thinking about Mark. Thank you so much for this talk. I think you've really hit on something that a lot of us spend. This koan's really applicable. So, and I think that's kind of come out in this talk. I'm somebody who loves to play Jeopardy and Trivial Pursuit. I love to overanalyze and engineer and all of that stuff. And the thing that I think I've really leaned into so often, and especially I think as Westerners practicing Buddhism, we get all the magazines, we read all the books, and there is a natural inclination to want to sort of intellectualize this. And I've tried very hard to step away from it. And I was thinking about, as I moved through grief after my dad died, for me, it was this, I was trying to just intellectualize getting through it. Like, how am I going to do this? Right. And it's I suddenly just, in my head, I was walking along one day after like a year of just suffering and tremendous pain. I just had this law of physics pop in my head. Each and every action is met with an equal and opposite reaction. And I realized I was just pushing and the universe was pushing back. And I, for a year, I wasn't going anywhere. And I just let go. And things just sort of, suddenly I started moving again. And I find that with my Zazen time too, is I typically, if I have something I'm trying to figure out, I just set a quick intention. I sit on the cushion and I do not give it any thought. Zero, absolutely. I might not even... But I just find that the universe just sort of guides me there. And it's so mysterious. And I have no clue how it works. But anyways, for all of you heavy thinkers out there, just maybe try floating with the current a little bit and see how this works for you. Thank you.
Thanks.
Diane, I think, go ahead.
Hi, Mark and everybody. It's good to see you. Do you recall somewhere in the middle of your talk, you commented on causes and actions? The cause comes along, and then with the action that you take, that leads you into something else. Do you recall that?
Vaguely.
Okay. Well, if you find it, you can find it. You know, you can email me.
Sure. I think I probably said we cultivate according to our causes and conditions.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And you said something specifically, an action, something comes along, a cause comes along, which is, you know, something a seemingly a solid form, and then the action, and then the action that we take takes us away from the solidity somehow of that form.
I don't recall that part, but if it's okay, I'll send it to you.
Okay.
I mean, it's beautiful. Yep. I wish I'd said it. Yeah, the way that it's very easy. Just as a joke, I was talking to one of my childhood friends who's a fellow lapsed Catholic, and he said, "How's the Zen thing going?" And I said, "I don't know. They won't tell me what to do." There's a personality trait here for me that, like, I'm very attached to my actions, and there's something important to remember that my actions were dependent on the situation that they arose in contact with, right? That they can't be a possession any more than anything else can. Although I am responsible for them and I have to eat the consequences, they just happen because of the situation. Mm-hmm. And the situation included, you know, any confusion I might have had, but.
Mm-hmm. So Mark, at first, thank you. Great as always. And when you open the floor for questions, my first thought was, well, you're a hard act to follow. But at one point you said something about how conditioned actions are used to create conditionless situations or responses or you know, results or something. I can't remember what you said exactly.
Fujian's poem. That thing was great. I could find that in my notes very easily. All is attained through conditions, yet what is attained is not a condition. And my interpretation of that was conditions as a means for attaining something that transcends conditions. Yeah. Yeah, to be liberated through conditions rather than from them is pretty interesting.
Yeah.
Diane has her hand up. Was that the line you were looking for, Diane?
Mark, I was a little disappointed. Hakujo and the Fox, it seems like it would have been a natural.
Well, then I couldn't have used my cathedral story.
I thought for sure you were going there, but it was like, no, you took a right turn.
Yeah, it's one of the greats, right? Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
All right, well, it's 12:13. Any last remarks? All right. Well, thank you very much, everybody, and I will do a dedication of merit. We offer the merit of this Sangha discussion to all so that they may be able to obtain the truth. All Buddhas throughout space and time, all honored ones, Bodhisattvas, Mahasattvas, wisdom beyond wisdom, Maha Prajna Paramita.
Thank you, Mark.
Thank you again, Mark. It was great.
Thank you, Mark.
Have a good week, everybody.
You too.